The Monster by Joe Haldeman. Start at the beginning? Which beginning? Okay, since you be from outside, I give you the whole thing. Sit over there, be comfort. Smoke 'em if you got 'em. They talk about these guys that come back from the NOM all fucked up and shit, and say they be like time bombs. They go along okay for years, then get a gun and just go crazy. But it don't go nothing like that for me. Even though there be the gun involved this time, and an actual murder this time. First time I be in prison, after the court-martial, I try to tell them what it be, and what they get me? Social workers and shrinks. Guy to be a shrink in a prison ain't be no good shrink. What they can make outside is the way I figure it. So at first I don't give them shit. But then I always get discipline. So I figure what the hell, and make up a story. You watch any TV, you can make up a NOM story too. So some of them don't fall for it. They go along with it for a while, because this is what crazy people do, is make up stories. Then they give up, and another one comes along, and I start over with a different story. And sometime when I know for sure they don't believe, when they start to look at me like you look at an animal in the zoo, that's when I tell them the real true story. And that's when they smile, you know, and nod, and the new guy come in next. Because if anybody would make up a story like that one, he'd have to be crazy, right? But I swear to God it's true. Right, the beginning. I be a lerp in the NOM, which means long-range recon patrol. You look in these magazines about the NOM, and they make like the lerps be always heroes. Brave boys go out and face Charlie alone, bring down the artillery on them and all. But it was not like that. You didn't want to be no lerp where we be. They make you be a fucking lerp if they want to get rid of your ass, and that's the God's truth. Now I can tell you right now that I don't give a flying fuck for that U.S. Army, and I don't like it even more when I be drafted. But I got to admit they be pretty smart, the way they do with us. Because we get off on that lerp shit. I mean, we be one bunch of badass brothers and good old boys, and we did love that rock and roll, and God they give us rock and roll. Fuck your M16. We get real Tommy guns with 100-round drum. Usually one guy get your automatic grenade launcher, one guy carry that starlight scope, another guy the full demo bag. I mean, we could have taken on the whole fucking North Vietnam Army. We could have killed fucking Rambo. Now, I like to talk strange, though any time I want, I can talk like other people. Even Jamaican, like my mama, ain't understand me if I try. I be born in New York City, but at that time my mama be only 3 months there. When she speak her English, it be island music, but the guy she live with, bringing me up, he be from Taiwan. So in between them, I learn shitty English, same shitty Chinese, and live in Cuban neighborhood, for el español shitty. He was one mean motherfucking Chinese cab driver, slap shit out of me for 12 years, and then I take a kitchen knife and slap him back. He never come back for the year. I think maybe he go off someplace and die. I don't give a shit anymore. But when I be drafted, they find out I speak Chinese, send me to language school in California. And I be so dumb I believe them when they say this means no NOM for the boy. I stay home and translate for them, tapes from the radio. So they send me to the NOM anyhow, and I go a little wild. I hit everybody that outranks me. They put me in the hospital, and I hit the doctor. They put me in the stockade, and I hit the guards. The guards hit back. Some more hospital. I figure sooner or later they got to kill me or let me out. But then one day this strapped dude come in and tell me about the lerp shit. It sound all right, even though the dude say if I fuck up they can waste me and it's legal, By now I know they can do that shit right there in LBJ, Long Bin Jail. So what the fuck? In 2 days, I'm in the jungle with 3 real badass dudes, with a map and a compass, and enough shit we could start our own war. They give us these maps that never have no words on them, like names of places. Just Town Pop 1000, and shit like that. They play it real cute, like we so dumb we don't know there be places outside of Vietnam where no GIs can go. They keep all our ID in base camp, even the dog tags, and tell us not to be captured. Die first, they say. That shall be more pleasant. We laugh at that later. But I keep to myself the way I do feel. That the grave be one place we all be getting to, long road or short, and maybe the short road be less bumps, less trouble. Now I know from 20 years how true that be. They don't tell us where the place be we leave from, after the slick drop us in, but we always sure as hell head west. Guy named Duke, mean honky, but not dumb, he say all we be doing is harassment, busting up supply lines coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Cambodia. It do look like that, long lines of gooks carrying ammo and shit, sometime on bicycles. We would set up some mine and some claymores, and wait till the middle of the line be there, then pop the shit, then maybe waste a few with the grenade launcher and Tommy guns, not too long so they ain't regroup and get us. Duke be taking a couple Polaroids, and we go 4 different ways, meet a couple miles away, then sneak back to the LZ and call the slick. We go out maybe 6 time a month. Maybe lose 1 guy a month. Me and Duke make it through all the way to the last one. That last one. That time no different from the other times, except they tell us, try to blow a bridge up. Not a big bridge like the movies, but one that hang off a mountainside. Be hard to fix afterward. It also be hard to get to. We lose 1 guy, new guy name of Winter, just trying to get to the fucking bridge. That be bad in a special kind of way. You get used to guys getting shot or be wasted by frags and like that. But to fall like 100 feet onto rocks be a different kind of bad. And it just break his back or something. He laying there and crying, tell all the world where we be, until Duke shut him up. So it be just Duke and Cherry and me, the chink. I am for going back. No fucking way they could blame us for that. But Duke crazy for action. Always be crazy for killing. And Cherry would follow Duke anywhere. I think he a fag even then. Later I do know when the monster killed them. This is where I usually feel the need to change. It's natural to adjust one's mode of discourse to a level appropriate to the subject at hand, is it not? To talk about this monster requires addressing such concepts as disassociation and multiple personality, if only to discount them. And it would be awkward to speak of these things directly the way I normally speak, as chink. This does not mean that there are 2 or several personalities resident within the sequestered hide of this disabled black veteran. It only means that I can speak in different ways. You could as well if you grew up switching back and forth among Spanish, Chinese, and 2 flavors of English, chocolate and vanilla. It might also help if you had learned various Vietnamese dialects and then spent the past 20 years in a succession of small rooms, mainly reading and writing. There still be the bad motherfucker in here. He simply uses appropriate language, the right tool for the job, or the right weapon. Let me save us some time by demonstrating the logical weakness of some facile first-order rationalizations that always seem to come up. 1, that this whole monster business is a bizarre lie I concocted and have stubbornly held on to for 20 years, which requires that it never have occurred to me that recanting it would result in much better treatment and possibly release. 2. That the monster is some sort of psychological shield or barrier that I have erected between myself and the enormity of the crime I committed. That hardly holds up to inspection, since my job and life at that time comprised little more than a succession of premeditated cold-blooded murders. I didn't kill the two men, but if I had, it wouldn't have bothered me enough to require elaborate psychological defenses. 3. That I murdered Duke and Cherry because I was upset at discovering them engaged in a homosexual act. I am and was indifferent toward that aberration or hobby. Growing up in the ghetto and going directly from there to an army prison in Vietnam, I witnessed perversions for which you psychologists don't even have names. Then, of course, there is the matter of the supposed eyewitness. It seemed particularly odious to me at the time that my government would prefer the testimony of an erstwhile enemy soldier over one of its own. I see the process more clearly now, and realize that I was convicted before the court-martial was even convened.
The details? You know what a Hoi Chan was?
You're too young.
Well, Chiu Hoi is Vietnamese for open arms. If an enemy soldier came up to the barbed wire with his hands up, shouting Chiu Hoi, then in theory he would be welcomed into our loving, also open, arms, and rehabilitated. Unless he was killed before people could figure out what he was saying, the rehabilitated ones were called Hoi Chans, and sometimes were used as translators, and so forth.
Anyhow, this Vietnamese deserter's story was that he had been following us all day, staying out of sight, waiting for an opportunity to surrender. I don't believe that for a second. Nobody moves that quietly, that fast, through unfamiliar jungle. Duke had been a professional hunting guide back in the world, and he would have heard any slightest movement. What do I say happened? You must have read the transcript. I see. You want to check me for consistency. I had sustained a small but deep wound in the calf, a fragment from a rifle grenade, I believe. I did elude capture, but the wound slowed me down. We had blown the bridge at 1310, which was when the guards broke for lunch, and had agreed to rendezvous by 1430 near a large banyan tree about a mile from the base of the cliff. It was after 1500 when I got there, and I was worried. Winter had been carrying our only radio when he fell, and if I wasn't at the LZ with the other two, they would sensibly enough leave without me. I would be stranded, wounded, lost. I was relieved to find them still waiting. In this sense, I may have caused their deaths. If they had gone on, the monster might have killed only me. This is the only place where my story and that of the Hoi Chan are the same. They were indeed having sex. I waited under cover rather than interrupt them. Yes, I know. This is where he testified I jumped them and did all those terrible things. Like he had been sitting off to one side, waiting for them to finish their business. What a bunch of bullshit. What actually happened, was that I was hiding there behind some bamboo, waiting for them to finish, so we could get on with it, when there was this sudden loud crashing in the woods on the other side of them, and bang! There was the monster. It was bigger than any man, and black. Not black like me, but glossy black, like shiny hair. And it just flat smashed into them, bashed them apart. Then it was on Cherry. I could hear bones crack like sticks. It bit him between the legs, and that was enough for me. I was gone. I heard a couple of short bursts from Duke's Tommy gun, but I didn't go back to check it out. Just headed for the LZ as fast as my leg would let me. So I made a big mistake. I lied. Wouldn't you? I'm supposed to tell them sorry the rest of the squad got eaten by a werewolf?
So while I'm waiting for the helicopter, I make up this believable account of what happened at the bridge. The slick comes and takes me back to the fire base, where the medics dress the wound and I debrief to the major there. They send me to Tui Hua, nice hospital on the beach, and I debrief again to a bunch of captains and a bird colonel. They tell me I'm in for a Silver Star. So I'm resting up there in the ward, reading a magazine, when in comes a couple of MPs and they grab me and haul me off to the stockade. Isn't that just like the army, to have a stockade and a hospital? What has happened is that this gook, Honorable Hoi Chan Nguyen Van Trong, has come out of the woodwork with his much more believable story. So I get railroaded and wind up in jail. Come on now, it's all in the transcript. I'm tired of telling it. It upsets me. Oh, all right. This Nguyen claims he was a guard at the bridge we blew up, and he'd been wanting to escape. They don't say desert. Ever since they'd left Hanoi a few months before. Walking down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So, in the confusion after the blast, he runs away. He hears Duke and Cherry and follows them, waiting for the right opportunity to go Chiu Hoi. I told you how improbable that actually is. So he's waiting in the woods while they blow each other, and up walks me. I get the drop on them with my Thompson. I make Cherry tie Duke to the tree. Then I tie Cherry up, facing him. Then I castrate Cherry with my teeth. You believe that? And then with my teeth and fingernails, I flay Duke, skin him alive, from the neck down, while he's watching Cherry die. Then, for dessert, I bite off his cock, too. Then I cut them down and stroll away. You got that? This Nguyen claims to have watched the whole thing. Must have taken hours. Like he never had a chance to interrupt my little show. What, did I hang on to my weapon all the time I was nibbling away? Makes a lot of sense. After I leave, he say he'd try to help the two men. Duke, he say, be still alive, but not worth much. Say he follow Duke's gestures and get the Polaroid out of his pack. When those pictures show up at the trial, I be a had daddy. Forget that his story ain't making sense. Forget for Christ's sake that he be the fucking enemy. Picture of Duke be still alive and his guts all hanging out. This god-awful look on his face. I could have been fucking Sister Teresa, and they wouldn't have listened to me. At this point the respondent was silent for more than a minute, apparently controlling rage, perhaps tears. When he continued speaking, it was with the cultured white man's accent again. I know you are constrained not to believe me, but in order to understand what happened over the next few years, you must accept as tentatively true the fantastic premises of my delusional system. Mainly, that's the reasonable assertion that I didn't mutilate my friends, and the unreasonable one that the Cambodian jungle hides at least one glossy black humanoid over 7 feet tall, with the disposition of a barracuda. If you accept that this monster exists, then where does that leave Mr. Nguyen Van Trong? One possibility is that he saw the same thing I did and lied for the same reason I initially did, because no one in his right mind would believe the truth. But his lie implicated me, I suppose, for verisimilitude. End of Side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 3, Cutting Edge, edited by Dennis Etchison. The Monster Continued. Continuing on page 59. A second possibility is the creepy one, that Nguyen was somehow allied with the monster, in league with him. The third possibility is that they were the same. If the second or the third were true, it would probably be a good policy for me never to cross tracks with Nguyen again, or at least never to meet him unarmed. From that it followed that it would be a good precaution for me to find out what had happened to him after the trial. A maximum security mental institution is far from an ideal place from which to conduct research, but I had several things going for me. The main thing was that I was not, despite all evidence to the contrary, actually crazy. Another was that I could take advantage of people's preconceptions, which is to say, prejudices. I can tune my language from a mildly accented Jamaican dialect to the almost impenetrable patois that I hid behind while I was in the army. Since white people assume that the smarter you are, the more like them you sound, and since most of my keepers were white, I could control their perception of me pretty well. I was a dumb nigger, who with their help was getting a little smarter. Finally, I wangled a work detail in the library, run by a white lady who thought she was hard-ass, but had a heart of purest tapioca. Loved to see us goof off, so long as we were reading. I was gentle and helpful and appreciative of her guidance. She let me read more and more, and of course I could take books back to my cell. There was no record of many of the books I checked out. Computer books. She was a nice woman, but fortunately not free of prejudice. It never occurred to her that it might not be a good idea to leave her pet darky alone with the computer terminal. Once I could handle the library's computer system, my Nguyen project started in earnest. Information networks are wonderful, and computerized ordering and billing is, for a thief, the best tool since the credit card. I could order any book in print. After all, I opened the boxes, shelved the new volumes, and typed up the catalog card for each book, if I wanted it to be cataloged. Trying to find out what the monster was, I read all I could find about extraterrestrials, werewolves, mutations, all that science fiction garbage. I read up on Southeast Asian religions and folk tales, psychology books, because Occam's razor can cut the person who's using it, and maybe I was crazy after all. Nothing conclusive came out of any of it. I had seen the monster for only a couple of seconds, but the quick impression was, of course, branded on my memory. The face was intelligent, perhaps I should say sentient, but it was not at all human. Two eyes, okay, but no obvious nose or ears. Mouth too big, and lots of teeth like a shark's. Long fingers with too many joints, and claws. No mythology or pathology that I read about produced anything like it. The other part of my Nguyen project was successful. I used the computer to track him down, through my own court records and various documents that had been declassified through the Freedom of Information Act. Not surprisingly, he had emigrated to the United States just before the fall of Saigon. By 1986, he had his own fish market in San Francisco. Pillar of the community, the bastard. 18 years of exemplary behavior, and I worked my way down to minimum security. It was a more comfortable and freer life, but I didn't see any real chance of parole. I probably couldn't even be paroled if I'd been white and had bitten off the cocks of 2 black men. I might get a medal, but not a parole. So I had to escape. It wasn't hard. I assumed that they would alert Nguyen and perhaps watch him or even guard him for a while. So for 2 years I stayed away from San Francisco, burying myself in a dirt-poor black neighborhood in Washington. I saved my pennies and purchased, or contrived, the tools I would need when I eventually confronted him. Finally, I boarded a Greyhound, crawled to San Francisco, and rested up a couple of days. Then, for another couple of days, I kept an intermittent watch on the fish market, to satisfy myself that Nguyen wasn't under guard. He lived in a 2-room apartment in the rear of the store. I popped the back door lock a 30-minute before closing and hid in the bedroom. When I heard him lock the front door, I walked in and pointed a .44 Magnum at his face. That was the most tense moment for me. I more than half expected him to turn into the monster. I had even gone to the trouble of casting my own bullets of silver in case that superstition turned out to be true. He asked me not to shoot and took out his wallet. Then he recognized me and clammed up. I made him strip to his shorts and tied him down with duct tape to a wooden chair. I turned the television on fairly loud, since my homemade silencer was not perfect, and traded the Magnum for a .22 automatic. It made about as much noise as a fly swatter each time I shot. There are places where you can shoot a person, even with a .22, and he will die quickly and without too much pain. There are other sights that are quite the opposite. Of course, I concentrated on those, trying to make him talk. Each time I shot him, I dressed the wound so there would be a minimum of blood loss. I first shot him during the evening news, and he lasted well into Johnny Carson, with a new bullet each half hour. He never said a word, or cried out, just stared. After he died, I waited a few hours and nothing happened, so I walked to the police station and turned myself in. That's it. So here we be now. I know it be life for me. Maybe it be that rubber room. I ain't care. This be the only place be safe. The monster he know. I can feel. This is the end of the transcript proper. The respondent did not seem agitated when the guards led him away. Consistent with his final words, he seemed relieved to be back in prison, which makes his subsequent suicide mystifying. The circumstances heighten the mystery, as the attached coroner's note indicates. State of California, Department of Corrections, Forensic Pathology Division, Glenn Malin, M.D., Ph.D., Chief of Research. I have read about suicides that were characterized by sudden hysterical strength, including a man who had apparently choked himself to death by throttling, though I seem to recall that it was a heart attack that actually killed him. The case of Royce Chink Jackson is one I would not have believed if I had not seen the body myself. The body is well muscled, but not unusually so. When I'd heard how he died, I assumed he was a mesomorphic weightlifter type. Bones are hard to break. Also, his fingernails are cut to the quick. It must have taken a burst of superhuman strength to tear his own flesh without being able to dig in. My first specialty was thoracic surgery, so I well know how physically difficult it is to get to the heart. It's hard to believe that a person could tear out his own. It's doubly hard to believe that someone could do it after having brutally castrated himself. I do have to confirm that that is what happened. The corridor leading to his solitary confinement cell is under constant video surveillance. No one came or went from the time the door was shut behind him until breakfast time, when the body was discovered. He did it to himself, and in total silence. G.M. W.R. Joe Haldeman is the author of The Forever War, Mind Bridge, All My Sins Remembered, Dealing in Futures, and The World's Trilogy. A winner of both the Hugo and the Nebula Award, his short works have appeared in Playboy, Omni, and many other magazines and anthologies since the early 1970s. He recently completed a screenplay and is currently at work on new short stories and a novel.